Hello, hello, your backup plan tribe, to another awesome, awesome show brought to you by Tina. Tina here at Your Backup Plan app. I'm the creator and developer of Your Backup Plan. I'm a best-selling author in the blink of an eye. That's how quick something can happen. Something when you go to the doctor and the doctor says you've now got this. That's how quick something happens. Or a car hits you and you don't have that 5-minute evacuation notice. Like, hold on a second, you can't hit me yet, I'm not ready. It's that kind of thing. I'm also a financial advisor and an emergency preparedness coach. And I am on all podcast platforms. And this has to be a song for you guys. YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Twitter, LinkedIn, and Pinterest. So make sure we are everywhere. You can find us everywhere. So happy to have you guys on our show. Make sure you like, share, and subscribe down here in the corner, because we want to see more of you and you want to see more of us. We talk about real life stories on our show with really amazing people like our wonderful guest, Kay Burnham from California today. I'm so excited to have her on our show. They talk about their life-changing event in their life. And boy, she had a life-changing event of tragedies, trauma, sickness, life-changing events, something unexpected hits you. And there's no 5-minute evacuation notice, sometimes no time at all. And you have to be able to make those right choices, the right decisions at that time, the right emotions to have at that time. And believe me, when something tragic happens, your brain just disappears into thin air and you're unable to think properly for years after even. I've had clients that said it's 2 or 3 years later and I still can't think straight. So don't ignore the chance, the moments that you have today and tomorrow to be able to talk about these things with your partner, your loved one, your spouse, your kids, your family, because you never know when something might happen. And we created that app just because we want it all organized in one place, all your details, everything that's up in your spouse's head, everything that's up in your head, where's those keys, you know, for that shed in the back? What kind of cat food does my cat and dog eat? Where do I have a safety deposit box? All of these kinds of things are at your fingertips when you need them the most. And they help guide you and ensure that your life puzzle pieces are all in one place in that complicated world that we live in. So let's get this party started. We have a short commercial and we're going to bring Kay on. So stay tuned. Here we go, quick. Involved in the song that I could just listen to that all day long. Welcome back, you guys. Welcome back to our show with Kay Burnham from California, who lost her husband to prostate cancer. And we called this making the most of the time we have, reflections on losing a spouse to prostate cancer. And a very special quote that I found for you guys. I'm going to bring Kay on and then start talking about this. Hey, Kay.
Hey.
Welcome, welcome aboard your backup plan. Oh, you have entered the portal. I found this wonderful quote for your story today. I was supposed to spend the rest of my life with me. I smile because I know you loved me till the day you went away, and will keep loving me till the day we're together again. By Natisha Bott. I thought that was really perfect for our story today. And Kay comes to us from beautiful California, and she is a mindful and leadership and well-being coach. And I did ask her about why it was so specific, but you'll know from her story why that is. So where did all of this start for you, Kay? Unbelievable story today.
Well, it started with my husband having some back pain. Yep. He was 43. And so naturally, the doctors assumed he had pulled a muscle or injured his back in some way and began treating that. But the pain wasn't going away. It was getting worse. And we couldn't think of anything he had done that would have caused an injury. So he went back again and they did some more tests and said, nope, it's got to be this, this old muscle is injury of some sort. We're just going to keep treating you with, for inflammation and rest and, all of those things you do for an injury.
Did the back problems, did they change where lower, mid, top, or was it just specific to one area?
Very specific to one area in his lower back. And then he came home one day from work, or actually he wasn't home from work. He was coming home from shopping or something and went to the restroom and came out and he said, I'm peeing blood. And I was homesick at the time, so I couldn't do anything with him. I'm like, you need to go to the emergency room. You need to go. If you're having that kind of problem, you need to get this figured out. So he went and they did some scans and they found a small mass in his bladder and said, okay, you need to follow up with your urologist, and recommended someone for him to go to.
Yeah.
He went there. They said, yeah, we need to get rid of this. This is what's causing the problem. So within 3 days of the bleeding, he was in for surgery. That quickly, wow. They got him in because they were concerned about it. And while he was in recovery, I got a call from the doctor that says, this doesn't look good. And I need you to prepare yourself that this may be cancer. We won't know for sure until the results come back, but that is what it appears just on my inspection. So I was like, oh, okay, we can do this. We can get through this. I've known plenty of people who have had cancer and gone through the treatments and recovered, and we're going to be good. We're going to be fine. So a week later, we were in the doctor's office being told that he had aggressive stage four prostate cancer that had spread to his bladder and throughout his body. And they wanted to do some more scans. And we found out that it was pervasively through his entire skeleton. The back pain he'd been having was because he had prostate cancer in his bones, in his back. His scans looked like Swiss cheese. The doctors were scared that he would break a bone just from normal activity. So he was really told to just curtail everything that could do anything. He wasn't even allowed to go get a massage because they thought the pressure from a masseuse, even light pressure, might break bones.
Oh dear.
Yeah.
Boy, was it aggressive.
It was. I forget what it's like, a Gleason scale, I think it's called. I don't remember now. But it's from 1 to 10, and they get really concerned about aggressive when it gets up to a 4, and he was an 8. They think that the cancer, even after the months of treating back pain, they feel like the cancer had really only been in his body maybe 3 or 4 months when they caught it. It was that aggressive.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah.
So we started chemotherapy, which, and we started a whole bunch of therapies. Chemotherapy was the predominant one. And that was interesting. Had a lot of the side effects you hear about. But his palliative care doctor was really great, really great. Unfortunately, my husband was also an addict. So he was really leery of taking Oxy, which is what was being prescribed for him. And so he didn't take it. So, yeah, because it was so intense. And he wasn't taking as much as he should, as regularly as he should. And the pain got out in front of him. And we ended up in the ER a couple of times before his palliative care doctor finally looked at him and said, if you're worried about addiction, I think the bigger problem is getting rid of the cancer and keeping you comfortable while we're doing that. We have plenty of things that can treat the addiction if that happens once you've kicked the cancer to the curb.
That poor guy, though, is just so mindset on this.
Yeah. Big mindset shift for him. And so he acquiesced and started taking the pain medication. But he had other, you know, side effects of nausea and fatigue and all of these other things too. And so his doctor recommended cannabis and told him that this was a legitimate way to treat his, especially his nausea, and keep his appetite up. So we did a deep dive and went into that world and started figuring out what was going to help him with that, which was very interesting.
Did it help?
Yes. It improved his quality of life immensely. And so anyone going through any kind of hard treatment where you're having appetite issues or energy or nausea, I really do advocate for exploring cannabis as a solution to that, because it helped him improve the quality of life. Absolutely. 100%.
It's just to find what works, like number wise, right? It's just hard to first figure out that.
It is. It's a lot of trial and error. I mean, with everything, even when with the palliative care doctor, it was a lot of trial and error on what's going to work and what's going to help and how are things interacting. And man, I became a nursemaid.
Immediately.
Yeah. And started learning everything I could about his treatments and everything that was going on and what I could do to, from a holistic perspective, can we change how we're eating that can help? What can we find? Anything that was going to make him more comfortable as we went through this. And at first the treatment, the chemo treatment was really working. And for a good while, it reduced all of his PSA scores and everything were going down. It was what we wanted to see. It was exciting until the day it wasn't. And that all of a sudden the numbers started going back up again and the treatment wasn't working. This cancer was so aggressive and adaptive that we just kept having to try different and more severe forms of treatment. He even got approved for a trial, not a clinical trial, but a newer treatment at the time, where they take your white blood cells out. They train them to attack the specific cancer that you have. Then they put them back into your body. And this was looking really hopeful and he qualified for it. But then in the process of scheduling all of the appointments and getting everything ready, his numbers went askew again and he no longer qualified for the treatment.
Oh.
Yeah, it was disappointment after it was the elation of things are working. Yes. And then everything comes crashing back down again. And for us, it was trying to find that middle ground where we could kind of stay hopeful, but not so attached to the progress that we didn't come crashing back down when things changed.
And how did that change his work? Was he working at during this time, or was it just too much?
At first he was lucky enough to be working remotely. He worked at the time from home, kind of odd hours. He was working East Coast hours, even though we were in the West Coast. So he was getting up really early and he was done with his day while the kids were still at school. So he had time to rest. His company was incredibly supportive of his treatment and what he was doing and how he was working. So they were very accommodating when things would come up. But eventually he couldn't stand to sit for periods of time. It was painful. He had to be lying down, or he had to be able to get up and move around, and working just wasn't going to happen. Yeah.
Working wasn't working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That must have been hard for him.
It was incredibly hard for him. His identity was closely tied to the work he did. He was a tech guy, and he found such enjoyment in going in and solving tech issues and problems. When he couldn't do that, he just sat around and had to find other things to occupy his mind and time. Which a lot of it was, you know, watching true crime shows on TV.
Yeah. Well, otherwise you're just going to worry about yourself. So.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And how was that for you?
Oh my gosh, it was hard. At the time that he was diagnosed, my father was going through cancer treatment as well. And he suddenly passed away. And my company reorganized, and I was pulled into a senior level position with all kinds of new responsibilities. So I was juggling a vice president level responsibilities in a 365 day a year live event organization on top of managing all of my husband's care. I wouldn't have gotten through it without my family and the support of my family. My mom was a rock, and even after my dad passed, she really helped support my husband and I through our process as well. But it was hard. Luckily, I was in therapy. When all of this started out, I went into crisis and started having panic attacks. And so I knew that was not going to work for me in long
term. I don't know why.
Yeah. No stress. Nothing caused that.
No.
So luckily I also had my therapist to lean on, and she specialized in grief. So she really helped me understand all of the grief I was experiencing, because grief doesn't just happen once you've lost someone. When you know that there's the possibility of losing someone, you go through what's called anticipatory grief, and if you can start that grieving process and deal with it at that stage, it does make it so much easier to work through everything else that starts coming up.
That's for sure.
Yeah, I felt.
Even though they say you can never be prepared for when it does happen.
No, I was just going to say, I felt more prepared to deal with it, knowing that no amount of preparedness would ever make it easy. I still remember a couple of nights after my husband's passing, just being in absolute heart-wrenching tears, like uncontrollable, while laying in bed and thinking to myself, oh, I finally actually understand what the words mean to feel heartbreak. Because it was like my heart had been torn in two.
I think with the anticipatory one, I haven't experienced that, but I could picture that with, you know, like older parents and that type of thing, where it's a long drawn out sickness or whatever. I think that you grieve it because you know it's going to happen, but you're just hopeful. There's this little hint of hopefulness. So...
yeah,
I think that's when that changes. I think that's when the it's like the dam gets opened up. It's like whoosh.
Absolutely. Yeah. The day that changed for us was the day that we let go of hope, was the day we made the decision to enter hospice. Right. I mean, that is what that
that's
is.
That's a hard thing.
You are recognizing there is no more hope that this will be better.
Yeah.
Whew, even now, that's still hard to, it's hard to say.
Just to admit to go to hospice is hard.
Yeah.
just that.
Yep.
Even though it's the best place for the person, we know that by I haven't heard anything bad from anybody. Like, it's a beautiful place.
Well, and we were lucky enough for him to spend his hospice in our home. I say lucky because it meant that I could be with him 24/7. Our family could be there. People could come and go. There was nothing. He got to be in a comfortable space that felt like his, where he could have his things around him. And I know that made a difference for him because we talked about it. We talked about all the options and what it would be. And his palate, we had been talking with his palliative care doctor for months about, well, what does this mean? And how do we make that choice? How will we know when it's right to make that choice? So we had all the information because we wanted to make sure we knew. We didn't want to avoid facing all the possibilities that were in front of us. We didn't want to just focus on the hope. We wanted to know what everything was possible.
Even the hardest as it was. Mm-hmm. What kinds of things did you make sure that you did that during this time frame?
Well, we reprioritized our life, right? We stopped focusing on our long-term plans and goals and really started looking at the short term. We started looking at how to make the most of the time we had together as a family with our kids. How could he make the best memories possible for them and support them in growing into adulthood without him?
Yeah, I'm sure that was a strain on him.
It was hard. It was incredibly hard. So we talked about our books, our life as books. We are all books. We are all writing our stories. Our stories are always in motion, and we become chapters in each other's books. And maybe this chapter in our life's stories was coming to an end. There were still more chapters to be written. And so we just started framing everything in terms of that. And it made it easier for us to think about future chapters, what they could look like without a physical presence, and what we would want to know from him, what questions we had about what did he want for us? What were his visions of a future? Not that we would take them on as our own, but more so that as we were making choices, we would know deep within us what his desires were, how he would feel about what we were doing. And it brought comfort.
Oh, I'm sure it would bring comfort, especially in years moving forward. You know, Absolutely. The girls would know that the dad wanted this and this. And
they would know how proud, because all he really wanted for them was to live their life the way they wanted to be happy, to make the most of it, to not settle for less than what they deserved and what they wanted. And they hold on to that, especially our youngest. She really talks about how she knows her dad is proud of her right now. She knows that with what she's doing, her dad's looking down and he'd be proud of me for this. And she says it a lot. And it makes me smile that she knows that.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely wonderful, because that's like a good sense of appreciation and love. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What kinds of things other than that, like paperwork wise, did you have try to figure that out before the time happened?
Yeah, I'll say luckily for our situation, I was the one in the family that took care of all of our financial stuff. So I didn't have to worry about knowing, you know, all of our banking information and our mortgage and our insurance and everything around that. We were both involved, but I took care of it all.
Which mom normally doesn't happen.
I was going to say, exactly. My mom wasn't as lucky. My dad took care of everything in their relationship, And even when he got sick, he didn't show her how to pay their bills every month or where anything was. So when he passed, I had to come in and search through everything and cobble together what all of her bill paying was and how it worked and how to manage a budget and all of those things. It just, it really showed me at that point that when you divide up, it's important to divide up your household responsibilities so no one person feels overwhelmed. But the part that you miss is it's also important to make sure the other partner still knows everything they need to about what your responsibility was.
Yes.
Because I'll say my husband took on the responsibility of caring for our cats. And when he passed, I had no idea what vet he took them to.
Yeah. Like I said at the beginning of our introduction, I know. Sometimes I've had clients we didn't have about. Yeah, well, they go into like having a major operation and they tell the neighbor to stop in and check on the cats or whatever. But, you know, they die in the operation and nobody knows anything.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, luckily for my mom, my dad was diligent about keeping all the passwords and logins for all of their information very secure and safe. So she was able to get in and access everything.
That's one good thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've had clients having to, you know, pay someone to unlock the computer or unlock the safe. And then they find out after they pay to have it unlocked that there's like nothing in it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, where's all the stuff? Where's the will? Where's the, like everything?
Yeah, your backup plan app, that's brilliant. That is really, like, it just keeps it all organized in one place. And the more that you can do to organize everything about your life. And I think you've said it too, like, don't wait for there to be a reason to do it. There is a reason to do it because the thing we all forget is that we will all die.
Yeah.
It is going to happen. And it's important to have your stuff in order to not burden the people who are left behind with that on top of grieving you.
Oh, it's so hard. And your story is very similar to me going to a girlfriend's. She went into the hospital because of a cough, sort of like your husband, you know, like just a normal thing. Like you think it's just a backache or you sprained a muscle or whatever. And she went in and then the next day she stayed in for more tests. And then I get a call from her husband saying that she's not coming out because she has stage 4 lung cancer.
Oh, wow.
So very aggressive, going through again, the whole body just the same. And I remember going out on the patio with her, just like what you said. And it makes you realize, and this is what created your backup plan app, was just this. She took my hand and she wasn't too bad yet. Like it was near the beginning. It was 6 weeks and she had passed. That's how fast it went.
Wow.
But this was like in the second week. And she said, Tina, I just want to sit here and feel the breeze on my face. I want to see the blue sky. And I want to hear the birds. It didn't matter that her husband was at the store. They had a little dollar store. And he didn't know what the heck was going on there. Because she did everything.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It didn't, like, all of that doesn't matter anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've experienced it, you really know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. Absolutely. My whole life changed. I mean, as you would expect, but I mean, I'm in a completely different career now than I was when he was alive. And his death was part of the impetus for me changing because I really took a look at my life. I realized where I was headed was someone else's dream. It's what society had told me a career path looked like. And so that was the next logical step. And I had never stopped to think about what I really wanted and how I wanted my life to be.
Yeah.
And so realizing just how short, I mean, he was 45 when he passed away.
It's just wrong.
Yeah. It's knowing that at any moment I could receive that kind of diagnosis, right? I mean, obviously not prostate cancer, but I could have my own, right? Yeah. I could have my own something happen. And I wanted to make sure I looked back on my life and that it was what I wanted, that I was following my life and my plan and what was making me happy, not someone else.
Are you finding you're using your skills for having experienced all of this now with your clients?
Absolutely. I mean, probably the main thing that came out of this whole process for me is it really taught me how to hold space for someone else, for their pain and their feeling in a way that was supportive and nurturing. And I don't think I'd ever understood what that was like before this. And so it gives me a great place to sit for my clients and hold space for them and what they're going through and their development and learning to handle life's challenges.
I think the problem with actually hearing those words from the doctor is it's like somebody just took a knife and just cut the air, because everybody's like, I used to do a lot of life insurance for clients, and I don't concentrate on that anymore, but I did. And it taught me a lot about people, because everybody made up excuses that they could do it later. They'll feel better later, or they'll do it later, or they'll have more time later, or whatever it is. But we don't stop this little mouse on a wheel that's going around in life. We're going to work and we're making plans and we're planning a trip and we don't know what's for dinner, and then we're meeting with friends. Like, it just keeps going around and around and around. But we don't stop and think of the moment right now.
Yeah.
And we don't. We just don't do that enough. And when we get a chance to look at that, we look at it so differently, because all of a sudden, am I happy? Am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing? You know, like, I think you look at money differently. I think you look at life differently. And I'm trying to get the word out there so people don't wait before something happens to do something, and start working on it little bit by little bit. And just this month, I'm going to do this part, and next month, I'm going to do this part. And that's what I was trying. It's just, why do we have to wait for something to happen? I just don't understand that.
Because we're excellent at it. Humans are excellent at avoiding the things they don't want to have to feel or deal with. We are.
That's it. Feel. We don't want to feel it.
Yeah. Because to deal with it, to really think about it and to handle it and to put everything in place, you have to feel those emotions. It's the logical brain is telling you where to go and what you need to do, but the emotions come up because there's this awareness that develops. And that's the part that people have trouble dealing with, is the discomfort around that.
Yeah. The discomfort, even to you and your husband when he did pass away, it's the discomfort of people not knowing what to say or how to say it. And they don't want to feel it either. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really hard. And so many of the things that we are taught or told to say to people who are grieving. Now, in the last few years, I've seen a change in this. I've seen there's starting to be a shift, but so many of the things we're told to say to people are just, they're not helpful. they don't actually make someone feel better.
Can go over those. I wanted to make sure everybody knows that Kay's information is down below in the description box below. And make sure you like, share, and subscribe to our channel, because we want to see you here all the time and watching our shows and sharing them with those that you love and care about, because it's going to make a difference to what people understand. And I mean, every guest that I have come on have these amazing, unusual stories that just bring you sometimes to my tears. I have to admit, I'm not very good at keeping my tears held up. I am terrible at it, actually. I had a story last. I do Walking with Tina on Friday on my Instagram channel. And every 3 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, I'll take a topic. Like a celebrity, for example, I spent probably 2 weeks on Lisa Marie Presley's death. And what a mess it is. And it doesn't matter what color you are, how much money you have, who you are, what color eyes you have, how old you are. It doesn't matter. Just doesn't matter. But I talked about with this girlfriend of mine how crazy and what a feeling it is to go into an emergency ward thinking that you're going in for tests and that you're going to, you know, they're going to help you feel better. That's why you go. And then to realize that you're never, ever coming out again. Mm-hmm. You walked in there and you're never coming out of the hospital. And I tell people to really just close their eyes and think about that. Because that makes a huge difference on how your life just changes in an instant. It's just mm-hmm. like when you go to the hospice, that must have been very difficult for you guys. Because you knew it was the right choice and you knew it was more comforting for him. But it's a hard choice.
It's a very hard choice. It was, and I carried so much guilt. It took me a while to process the guilt around making that decision. I mean, I actually had thoughts that were, oh my God, I'm killing my husband, right? I'm choosing to let him die. Like that's awful. What kind of person I am that would choose to give up this fight? And it wasn't my fight, it was his. And I wasn't doing anything but supporting him in his desire to not live a quality of life that was awful. You know, he ended up collapsing. That going in and knowing you're never coming out, he came out, but he collapsed one day. I got home to find him on the floor and my girls trying to figure out how to get him up. And then we had a long conversation about calling 911. We called 911 and the paramedics came and they got him up, and in talking with us, they realized he was running a fever and said, nope, he's got a fever. We're taking him to the hospital. Thankfully they did, because he was starting to go into sepsis and would have died had he stayed at home. But what happened was he ended up having, the tumors had spread to his kidneys and they were closing off the tubes into the kidneys, or from the kidneys to the bladder. So he could no longer drain his kidneys. So they had to go in and put in nephrostomy tubes into both his kidneys. So
it was like poisoning him.
Exactly. It's what was his own body was poisoning him, because it couldn't release the toxins. And so at first they thought the tubes would be temporary, that if they could shrink the tumors that were causing the blockage, they could come out. But they very quickly realized that was not going to happen. The tumors would just grow back and close it off again. And so he was going to have to live the rest of his life with tubes coming out of his back and two pouches strapped to him to collect the urine.
Yeah.
He definitely didn't want that. He also ended up being bedridden because he just, his body couldn't release the fluid. So his legs swelled. He was unable. We did it. We pulled the trigger on hospice because it was the quality of life at that point he knew was never coming back. He was not going to be able to go out and do the things he enjoyed. He was going to be stuck in a bed with tubes. And that wasn't the life any of us wanted for him.
No. Especially someone so active as he was, right?
Yeah. We were going out every weekend. We were out. We'd been hiking in Zion, and we were avid Disney people. So we were, going to Disneyland all the time. We had annual passes. Well, that was never going to happen again. It's just everything he loved was gone from his life, the activities and such. And so life at that point wasn't worth it for him. It wasn't worth the agony and the pain he was in. The pain was,
The bone cancer is terrible.
Painful. There's just nothing you can do for bone pain the way that you can for any other kind of pain.
Yeah. So was it difficult having these real hard conversations that people say, oh, I don't want to do that,
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
I think it cries, doesn't it? It makes you feel closer bonding to that person, don't you think?
Yes. Yes. As hard as it was and all the tears that we shed, we felt closer than ever. We knew each other better. I mean, I was his primary caregiver through hospice. He was in our home, in our living room, we have a two-story home. So he was on the ground floor in a hospital bed. And I took to sleeping in our reclining chair next to his bed most nights. So I could get up in the middle of the night and help administer his medication, but all his pain medication to keep him from experiencing too much difficulty that way. But also so that we could talk well into the night while our girls were upstairs asleep. So we could really have private, intimate conversations. And oftentimes he would go to sleep and I would stay awake and continue to talk to him about our story and my feelings for him and what was going on, even when it got hard for him to speak.
Yeah. Just continue the process.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think he regretted anything?
Oh, he had lots of regrets. Most of them were around not reconciling with people sooner, holding on to grudges or old hurts and not letting them heal. But we had made, luckily he didn't have a lot of regrets about us, the closest people in his life. When our oldest entered high school, we sat down and had a conversation together just about how we had precious few years left, how prophetic that was, where the girls would want to be around us and want to spend time with us, right? They were before they went off to live their full adult lives, and that we needed the most of these 3-4 years as they're getting through high school and all of that to really bond and build memories as a family. And so we shifted our priorities toward that. And thankfully we did, because we took family vacations and did things that together more often to build those memories. And because the girls were older and in high school, these are memories that they still hold, that they could hold on to because they were conscious and we weren't making them because he was dying. So they aren't tinged with that. We were just making them because they were a priority and we wanted to bond with them.
That's lovely. What kinds of things do you deal with in your scope of work now that has to do with grief?
Well, a lot of my work is about really getting in touch and understanding your emotions, being able to become an objective observer of your thoughts and your emotions and knowing how to process them. So I help people get in touch with that side, get in touch with what their body is telling them, because a lot of what was going on for me when he was in hospice was understanding, oh, this is my body telling me if I don't rest right now, I'm not going to be any good to anyone. I now know this signal, right? Like, I've got to do this. In my grief, it was about, oh, okay, this is a trigger and I'm feeling it hardcore right now. How do I get through this moment to a place where I can process it? So understanding how to, and that it's okay to delay your emotional experience as long as you come back and process it, is something I help my clients with. But being able to reset your nervous system through mindfulness, through breathing and meditation helped immensely with my grief. I could go into it. I learned to be in a meditative state and the tears just flowed and yeah. It was okay. I didn't wipe them off. I didn't go to stop them. I just let them flow through this state and release that grief, release that pent up emotion that's in there, because that's what crying does for us. Crying, laughter, all of these things that we experience in our body are helping us process and release those experiences and emotions.
Well, that's beautiful. And I never thought I was going to take you into the, I can't believe the time already, the final message for the audience, because that's almost like a great one right there. Can you think of a final message?
So you're not alone. Grief can feel incredibly isolating. It can feel like no one understands. And while your grief is unique because your experience and your life is unique, there are others who have come out the other side of grief with gratitude, grace, and happiness. Find them. Connect to them, connect to other people who have been where you are, because it makes all the difference in the world.
Even for men, I know men have a difficulty in doing that.
Especially for men. Men have a hard time with their emotions because they receive so many messages about emotions being weak and to just soldier on and stiff upper lip and all of that. And especially when it comes to grief, that doesn't work. Doesn't work.
Because like I said, it has this switch of its own that you just aren't able to turn it off and on like you would like to.
Nope.
I wish I could. We could make a lot of money doing that.
Seriously.
I could sell them like thousands and thousands of them. Oh my goodness. I wish I could. There's lots of times when I'm just bawling and I'm like, where's that switch? Okay, let's flick that switch so that I can stop. I don't know. It's such a crazy thing, this grief. I think it's hard too, because it seems to pile up on all the other stuff that you have in you, you know, like a bad relationship or a bad work experience or a bad person or trauma in your when you were growing up, and it just adds to all of that stuff.
That is absolutely a fact. That is where I found myself in all of this, was all of the trauma, grief, and everything that I hadn't dealt with had piled up in my life. And I'll tell you, when I went through the process, because part of the process was documenting all of the points of grief in my life from the time I could remember forward, I was amazed at how much had piled up that I hadn't dealt with. And dealing with it, processing it, facing it, as difficult and uncomfortable as it was, is what allowed me to move into the space of gratitude and grace that I live in now.
Right. And helping other people,
mm-hmm.
which I love, because that's what it all seems to, all these life-changing events seem to turn people into helping others. It's just crazy how that happens.
We're all on a path. Life is a journey and we're all on it. just some of us are a little farther along on some aspects of it than others. And turning around and putting a hand out to the people who are coming up behind you helps shortcut their journey and uplifts everyone, right? A rising tide lifts all boats.
It does. It's beautiful. Well, thank you, Kay. It's the end of our show already. I can't believe it, how fast that goes. We have so much more to say, you know. I could really dig deeper into things that you take that time that you think is, it's hard because you're in this time of, he's going to get better. There's hope and, you know, we do this and it's going to make it better. And so then you put off having a plan because you're going to get better. And then all of a sudden it just like, uh-oh, now we're at the stage. And so quickly.
Yep. Just like that, everything changes.
It does. So thank you, Kay, for coming on our show. I couldn't have done it without you, with your story. It's, thank you so much. It's very heartfelt. And you know, guys, we are not Superman, but we act like we are, because nothing's going to happen, right? But as you know, that's far from the truth. Things are going to happen. And we have no control of that. It might be a serious sickness. It might be just recovery. I shouldn't say just, but you know, you might be in the hospital for 2 or 3 months and then you're on a different road path altogether. And it might be a hurricane or losing your house or whatever it might be, losing your kids or a spouse or a partner or just losing yourself in the midst of getting sick of yourself as well. And we just don't look at these things close enough. And there's, you know, shootings in the schools and the streets mm-hmm. and work accidents and car accidents and overdoses. And the pandemic was a big one, not to mention all these crazy wars and natural disasters and these Chinese balloons up in the air. God, the UFOs that nobody wants to talk about. It's craziness. Craziness, I say. Wildfires and floods and hurricanes. And we can't forget the earthquakes that have been in Turkey and Syria this last week. We, Kay and I, are actually from the Pacific West Coast. So we know there's a big fault line all along our side of the North America. And it could happen tomorrow. It could happen tonight. We don't know when. So don't forget to smash that like button down below and hit that subscribe button. We'd love to have you. And if you are thinking about that special someone right now watching the show that you haven't said that you cared and loved to in the last while, make sure you do. Make sure you reach out to them today. Call them. We still have phones. Knock on the door. Zoom them. FaceTime them. Whatever it is. But tell them today how much you love and care about them. Because you don't know what tomorrow's going to bring. And that being said, I always end our show with Carol Burnett. Kay knows who Carol Burnett is. I'm so glad we had this time together just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started. And before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long. So long, everybody. It was a pleasure to have you, Kay. I loved your story. And
thank you.
I'm not going to say I'm sorry for what you've gone through because I know you've appreciated it all, every little bit of it. And I really appreciate you for coming on and helping people.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here.
And I'm grateful to have you. So thank you. And thank you, you guys. I'm grateful to have each and every one of you. And, you know, Mike Tyson's quote, famous quote, says, everyone has a plan until you get punched in the mouth. And that's very true. We think we have a plan. And then that all goes to pot, as they say. So every moment is magic. I had this come out yesterday, and I thought it was beautiful from a friend. Every moment is magic, so make every magic moment count. Stay safe, be kind, and expect the unexpected. Bye for now.